Mini-episode 1052 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 1052. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here today, and we have a very special segment coming up. We are welcoming back a favorite guest of ours from shows that we've done previously. I had the pleasure of actually interviewing this gentleman in person in New York back in 2012. He's been on the show a couple of times. And a gentleman with whom he does a lot of business, another CEO in the tech industry, is going to be on with us. I speak first of Alex Cohn, making another appearance back on the show. It's been a pleasure to have him on previously. I know when he was on in 2012 in New York, that was right around the time of the Mars rover deal with NASA, and found out during the course of that conversation that he had even done essentially rocket science back in the day with the space shuttle program. It was a pleasure to talk about that and much more with him. It's always a treat to have him on. Alex, welcome back to the FDH Lounge, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Glad to be back.
It's a pleasure to have you back. And it's a double pleasure because we have a gentleman who is a longtime business associate of yours, and a chance to welcome him onto the program for the first time. I speak, of course, of Gary Longsign, who is the CEO over at Illuminex, and another company that does a lot with Mac and iPhone software, and works in a lot of the same areas. And again, very cutting edge, high tech stuff that he works on. Gary, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today for the first time. How are you, sir?
I'm fabulous. It's a pleasure to be here as well.
It's a pleasure to have both of you gentlemen on. And as I had alluded to off air, I'd like to start on kind of a timely bit of a basis here that in recent days, as we are recording this conversation, one of the titans, one of the founding fathers, as it were, of Silicon Valley, Paul Allen, passing away. And at an untimely age, and a gentleman who subsequently branched out from Microsoft to become known for other things. One of our show contributors, Ben Chu, who lives in Portland, might best know him as owner of the Trailblazers and the Seattle Seahawks, but he is a gentleman who made a mark in a lot of different ways, but first and foremost in the world of technology and helping to shape the modern world that we have today and his association with Bill Gates. I'll start with you, Alex. Thoughts on the passing of Paul Allen and what he contributed in his lifetime?
Well, yeah, I think Paul is an interesting character. He's clearly contributed tremendously to the very early computer days. You know, Microsoft would not be Microsoft without his technical acumen and his strong contribution to their technology base. His partner Bill Gates went on to be the face of Facebook, making instrumental in making the technology happen. And he's been fascinating, post-Microsoft, as he's not only been a tremendous supporter of sports in the Seattle area, but also making a Museum of Science Fiction, being a tremendous, cultural contributor for everything from science fiction to cooking and, all kinds of other good stuff. So he will certainly be missed, and, it also certainly makes me sad just the concept that, he was still fairly young. He was still in his mid-60s, and if you had hundreds of millions of dollars, you could somehow beat whatever was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which was what actually took him out. When the time comes, it comes for all of us, so... farewell, Paul Allen, you'll be missed.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think that was a lesson that was driven home a couple of years ago with another one of the forefathers of Silicon Valley, Steve Jobs, and that, again, if that guy with all of his scratch couldn't find a cure that could save his life, it shows you how vulnerable everybody is. Gary, I'll pivot to you. Anything that you can add on this as far as thoughts on Paul Allen, his life, his legacy, and everything in between?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it in the last couple of days. The thing that he has done that I find most interesting is something that I think a lot of people are not aware of, although your audience has a certain curiosity about science and that type of thing. They may have heard of his involvement in a company called Strato Launch. He's making it basically a giant airplane that he would use to carry rockets up to, 40 or 50,000 feet and then launch the rocket with a sort of head start. And that has been sort of an ongoing R&D project for quite a while, but that plane is basically the sort of first version of it is ready to do test flights this year, next year, and it won't be too much longer, and they'll be doing some launches of rockets from it. That is one of these kinds of, large-scale, forward-thinking, big-picture sort of projects that there are not very many billionaires who spend their time doing this. It seems to me that most of the billionaires in the world, and there's only a couple thousand of them, but there are only a handful, and you can name them. Everybody knows who they are, for the most part. Possibly they know Paul Allen for other reasons, and they know other billionaires for other reasons. But the ones who are working on these really interesting, forward, far-reaching kinds of projects are few and far between. Undoubtedly there are a few doing interesting things who aren't really tooting their own horn, but Paul Allen didn't really toot his horn either. He just kind of went out and did it. That's a SpaceX level kind of investment in his own brain power. He's allocating the time that he uses to think about hard problems, and that's kind of what Elon Musk is doing too. And it's a loss to the world that Paul Allen, so young, it's only, I think, 65. There will be able to, that company will probably survive. Undoubtedly, he knew that this time would come and has arranged for his idea to carry on without him. Who knows if he'd lived another 10 or 15 years, what other big ideas he might have got interested in and decided to put some brain power behind to fund.
That's true. But as you very astutely point out, Gary, a great example of making every moment count. With the ideas and the projects and everything that he was doing while he was still here. The first question, I'm going to start with you, Alex, because we're just going to kind of, I want to revisit briefly something from a past show segment. And when we were in New York discussing this together in 2012, one of the topics that we were getting on about a little bit at the time was cloud computing, which was something of obviously a newer concept at the time, and you were kind of getting into that in a great degree and doing a wonderful job of kind of breaking it down for our audience. So I'd like to start there, because a lot of times I'm fascinated to sort of trace things through the history of our show. We go back to 2007, so in terms of how long we've been around, this is maybe the this is the fastest moving time in human history. So let me take this as a subject example right there. Cloud computing 2012 versus cloud computing today, Alex, how has it progressed?
Well, it's progressed tremendously. I think in 2012, to sort of flip this on the other hand, which can still be made a very good argument for maintaining your own physical computers in a data center somewhere, having it, whether you had a whole room full of things or a rack or something else like that. And I think, in the time that's elapsed, really, the ability to have, all the cloud computing resources that you want incredibly inexpensively, basically provided on demand as you need them or don't need them, has, come along and displaced really anybody but the most dedicated companies. Need to actually maintain their own physical infrastructure. The fact that I can go to Amazon and basically get, any quantity of computing resources that I could possibly imagine, available and, and just use them for this evening and then let them go. Not have to take any more payment than that is just mind-boggling. The fact that, if I have, an incredibly large sum of data stored physically at my location, I can even get Amazon to come send a truck over to transfer all the data to your storage and drive it away. It's just mind-boggling. So the whole concept of cloud computing has blossomed to an extent that was really almost impossible to imagine back in 2012. You know, we sort of thought we knew what cloud computing was, and it has moved onward tremendously to the point where we have a tremendous range of services, tremendous range of technologies, tremendous range of providers, and the cost has come down, you know, unbelievably to, you know, probably fractions of a penny on what it used to cost, you know, far less than that, maybe thousandfold, you know, the compute resources that we could get in the cloud and the storage resources we could get in the cloud have come down. It's just mind-boggling. And, you know, and it's become ever more useful. You know, you could use them for a tremendous range of tasks, and, you know, the technology to solve certain problems is available there now. You need face recognition, you need, artificial intelligence, you need, you know, big bookkeeping tasks, all, you know, there's, you know, go to books like Amazon, you know, you have libraries and, you know, infrastructure that you can rent to solve these problems, you know, on whatever scale you need. And, you know, it has really come of age to become something that is unbelievably powerful and was powerful to an extent you couldn't even imagine back in 2012.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that I enjoy most about our library of shows is that we'll talk about something in a moment of time, and as I say, everything has been so fast moving in these last dozen years that we've been around that you can go and you can see how it evolved and sort of compare it against what the forecasts were going to be, and it's just incredibly fascinating to me in that kind of a way. I'm going to pivot to you, Gary, on the time frame of the last half dozen years or so in terms of what you thought cloud computing was going to be versus what it is today. How is it the same, and how has it differed in some ways?
You know, I think the most interesting thing that I've noticed is how important it, and this hasn't quite happened yet, it's sort of happening, just starting to happen now, is how important cloud infrastructures have become to what we think of as, you know, smaller or medium-sized businesses. In the startup world, they're very aware of this because a lot of startups start out with a business model that they want to scale to essentially to a global reach, right? But there are lots of established businesses that depend on computing infrastructures of some kind that are starting to take a look at cloud services because what they're realizing is that even in a small or medium-sized business that has a local or regional reach rather than global, they depend on high availability. And the availability that they can get from a cloud-based infrastructure is sometimes is dramatically better than what they can provide for themselves because it is just so very expensive to provide a high availability system. And that's actually one of the things that sort of drove the original interest in cloud computing was, this idea that if you're a business and you want to have a scalable infrastructure, you have to put enormous investments into things that aren't really a part of your business, and you wind up having to run your own IT shop. So what a lot of businesses are doing now is realizing, and I think kind of finally, you know, some of these opportunities have been available for a while, but I think people were sort of waiting and watching and seeing whether this could really be a thing. So we've noticed in the last year or so, there is an increasing amount of businesses who are starting to explore this, and what they're finding right away is, well, we have these apps that we wrote for our own business that support our business or talk, you know, that help us engage with our customers in some way. Maybe it's an online, you know, just as simple as an online way for them to buy our stuff, whatever that is. And they need to basically migrate those apps into the cloud, which is not straightforward. It really does require some expertise and some deep thinking about what the nature of that app is. Sometimes you need to throw the app away and start over with a different set of technologies in order to provide the same customer experience, or even a better customer experience, in a way that you can host it on the cloud, reduce your internal IT costs. So I think that's probably the most interesting thing that I've been seeing. I'll give you an interesting example. I can't name the customer, but this is a customer that has a global type system, and this brings up another issue, too, and this is another driver. they had a bunch of customers in the United States, and then they started getting customers in Europe over the last probably 10 years or so that they've been in business, and they became a global company. And then suddenly the Edward Snowden stuff happened a few years ago, and their overseas customers suddenly became very concerned about the hosting infrastructure being in the United States. And they basically said, you know, we demand that you put a data center in Europe for us. So this company basically looked at their app and said, well, we can't really afford to run multiple data centers around the world. It's the reason, you know, the reason we were doing it this way is because we could afford to run one data center really well. We could run two or three data centers heavily if that's what you want. And they realized that essentially re-implementing their application, or refactoring it, as we say in the software world, that allowed them to put data centers into places that were overseas that their clients could trust. And I'm not saying that they were right. I'm not saying don't trust the U.S. That's not what I'm saying at all. But sure. I'm saying there were customers who were demanding this. And so they, you know, they refactored their app, hosted it in a cloud infrastructure in Europe, and there's another one in Asia. And that satisfied their overseas clients' requirements for a locally hosted infrastructure without them having to replicate a really expensive data center overseas. And in fact, it worked so well that they eventually shut down their own data center and they host in the United States on a cloud infrastructure as well.
It is really kind of fascinating the way that it has evolved, and both of you gentlemen, I think, did a very good job of breaking that down. I would like to now defer to, and I want to thank you, Gary, for sending some fine production notes here on some things that we can talk about. And one of the things that kind of grabbed me is something that we've talked about in other contexts on the show, and that being, of course, automation. And where things are going with that. We've talked about it on the show in a little bit of a socio-political context sometimes as far as what that's going to do to society, dislocation that might be coming. There's an optimistic school of thought that one of our contributors, Chris Galloway, has that for every job that is rendered obsolete, there will be a new job that is somehow made necessary in terms of helping to manage the automation. Notwithstanding the fact that artificial intelligence continues to make generational leaps, that's a thing that makes me kind of dubious just looking at it on the surface. But who better to ask than you two guys? And I'm going to start with you, Gary, on this here. Your thoughts on this the last couple of years, because I've noticed the same thing that you made note of in your notes, that it does seem to be accelerating as far as, and I've seen with my own two eyes, as far as jobs being lost directly to that, and something that just continues to kind of accelerate. So I don't know if we're before the inflection point of where the new jobs are going to come in, if this is the start of a trend in terms of how optimistic or apocalyptic we should be in terms of looking at this. As I say, I'll start with you, Gary.
I find this to be one of the most interesting questions facing humanity right now, actually. I studied economics when I was in college. I'm really familiar with the argument that you mentioned. That argument is what I would consider to be the classical economist argument. If you ask almost any economist, they will tell you the same thing. And the reason that they say that is because historically that has always been true. If you look at any of the history of technology inventions, you do find that in aggregate in the economy, there was so much new growth that happened as a result of those technological changes. There were new jobs that were created in sometimes unexpected ways. Now, I think that in the last 15 or 20 years with the rise of computer automation, one of the reasons that we saw that happen, when there were people who expected there to be job loss as a result of just basic automation of paperwork, one of the reasons that didn't happen is because it took so much, like, we weren't very good at it as a species yet. We weren't very good at automating things, and we weren't very good at building computers to do things that people used to do in other ways. But we're getting much better at it. And I think that we are not yet at the inflection point, and when it comes, we're going to see job loss that becomes measurable in the economic statistic. I think we're almost there. So the example that I like to point to, I'll direct your audience to a YouTube video called Humans Need Not Apply. It's the best summary that I've seen of this problem that's expressed in a way that anyone can understand, whether you have an economics degree or not. one of the key examples that they use in this video is horses. If you say to yourself, when the automobile is invented and the jobs for horses go away, the economy will create new jobs for horses, that's laughable. Like, everybody who hears that sentence laughs. But if you take the same sentence and you put humans in it, then it seems like it makes sense. And everybody, including all the professional economists in the world, including some of my favorite economists, like Paul Krugman, still holds to this line. And that is out and out wrong. And we're going to see that it's wrong. And we should know intuitively that it's wrong, because the nature of the jobs that get created, when you look at a massive technological leap like AI or robotic automation, what's really going to do it is a combination of artificial intelligence with the robotics. That combination is so powerful and has such a long reach that the nature of the jobs that get created isn't equivalent. You know, it isn't the case that everybody who needs a job is going to be a computer programmer or a robotics engineer. That's not something everybody can do or wants to do. And even if it were the case that this was somehow magically creating new jobs, which it will create new jobs, it's just that half the jobs in the economy are going to go away. And we know this is true because you can look at what those jobs are, and you realize a tremendous number of jobs in the economy are related to transportation. Well, we are on the verge today of automating task of moving things from point A to point B. And that automation will be so complete and so thorough and reach so deeply into the economy that just that single application of artificial intelligence technology with robotics will eliminate many millions of jobs just in the U.S. Now, there's an upside to this, which is that we will be able to provide goods and services to millions and millions of people who couldn't have them otherwise in the traditional economy. So we have, a flip side to this question. It's not just about job loss, even if that happens. Almost no one in the world agrees with me, right? All of the professional economists would say I'm wrong. I think I'm right, and I think we'll discover that we don't need everyone in the economy to be working in order to have a decent civilization. We will have a higher standard of living for almost everyone as a result of these changes eventually. It will be a very rough road getting from where we are to that point, especially because we are so recalcitrant politically. We don't want to face this question. We don't want to look at it. We can't look at climate change either, the rest of the world is sort of looking at it a little bit seriously. The United States ought to be leading on this question. We won't lead, and we're not leading a question of robotic automation either.
That, again, from your lips to God's ears as far as where we get to on this, I certainly, because, again, you raise a very interesting point that, it's going to cost a lot less to make these things if you don't have to factor salaries into the equation. So, God willing, that part of it is going to drive where we're going eventually. And, we might not all be earning any money, or, you guys still will be. You guys will always be in demand. The rest of us, maybe not so much, but maybe the things that the robots are making will at least be cheap enough that we can afford it on our piddling non-earnings. But pivoting to you, Alex, to get your thoughts on this. I mean, and this is something that I've said on the show over a period of time, just sort of half-jokingly, that in terms of when you look at the landscape as it is today, me personally, I'm a Rand Paul guy, but I can admit in looking at it that if we get to where we're going with this kind of mass displacement, the things Bernie Sanders is talking about today, he's going to sound like Ayn Rand in that world, because there's not a measure of redistribution that you can even contemplate in a world like that where nobody has jobs or few have jobs. The landscape is just going to be so radically different from whatever our spectrum is today. So are you as optimistic as...
I wish Star Trek had been more explicit in that. Gene Roddenberry, in particular, imagined this universe where it was very easy. The cost of creating stuff fell to zero.
Yeah.
And suddenly, what do you have? You have this society that has to be organized around a different principle. But he didn't really tell us what that was.
You could go to a bar and see some sort of alien girl dancing for you. You could go in and get your dinner out of a little slot by simply telling it what you wanted. But he really didn't spend any time on the out-of-work chefs and other types of people who've been displaced by this new technology.
Sure.
I mean, as a technologist, as a geek of a certain age, I've seen a lot of waves of technology come and go, and I've seen a lot of skills that I've put a tremendous amount of time and energy into acquiring suddenly become worthless from my point of view, I've really tried to spend as much time trying to distill out valuable lessons that are not specific to some particular technology. It doesn't really matter how you write this in Fortran. It's about managing your memory or managing your speed or doing this or that or the other thing. I've tried to find ways that I can continue to pull wisdom out of my experience and make my skill set less about specific skills and about that wisdom. But I think that's a very tough thing. I mean, as you say, in my father's time, everybody had a job and they worked in that particular job doing that particular thing for their entire life. And now we're at a stage where you more or less have to count on being able to do two or three different things over the course of your life at the very least. Because that great job you got out of high school or out of college, doesn't exist anymore. Nobody wants those buggy whoops anymore or whatever. You have to do something else, different, better, cooler. And it's a continuous challenge to be able to look at your experiences and just buy and pull the wisdom from it rather than just simply skills. And yes, it is a question. If we end up with a very small number of wise people who apply wisdom and everybody who used to do manual labor of one sort or another or apply specific skills is suddenly out of the job, then we are going to have a problem. Fortunately, this generally has always been something new that has come along that has sucked people in. People don't have to worry about making wooden wheels for Model Ts anymore, but found something else for those people to do. We live in New York City, and I remember, over the years, much hue and cry about various jobs in the subway being phased out and how well everyone lives. And yet we still managed to get around on the subway without all the extra people running around taking tokens and moving tokens around and things like that. So if you adapt and you keep your eye out and think about ways to apply a hard-won wisdom, I think you'll always find a way to get by.
Very good points, yeah. And that's, again, we don't know what we don't know as far as how other things are going to come from here on in. And in terms of the unforeseen, as far as inventions yet to come, yes, perhaps that will change the landscape in ways that we can only kind of squint at today. And again, I'm going to pivot to you, Gary, back to your notes here. You raised some interesting questions here in your notes about mobile apps. Whether it be second generation ones, consumer versus enterprise software. I think what I want to do with this is just sort of go very broad with both of you guys and let you talk about what you think is important in terms of what's going on with apps right now, things that you guys are working on, and really kind of take this any direction that you want to take this. I'll start with you, Gary.
Sure. So I think the reason they put this in there is because it's sort of a topic that Alex and I both feel doesn't get addressed a lot. Like we listen to some tech podcasts and stuff, and it's something that doesn't really come up that often, which is what are enterprises doing in order to build the next generation of software that they're going to use to interact with their customers. There is quite a bit of thought in the industry going into this. It just doesn't seem to get covered much. And there's a lot of energy going into this. And if you think back, it's only been 10 years since your iPhone came along, and that basically changed everything. Basically everybody else who was building what they thought at the time was a smartphone, they were focused on two things. One was accessing the web, and they weren't very good at that because they were taking up half the space on the front of the device with a keyboard. And the other thing was, how do you get you know, how can you use that keyboard to, you know, to interact with the your, whatever your service was. And so they were sort of focused on the, you know, well, let's make a voice response system that's better and these kinds of things. And to some extent, there might have been little inquiries going on in different directions. Well, it was only 10 years ago when the iPhone happened. Suddenly you have a native app on a device that's a fully functioning computer and has an enormous amount of power. It had more screen real estate than a typical computer did only 10 years before that. A desktop computer that weighed 30 pounds and, you know, was more than a cubic foot of your desk space and used 200 watts. So now suddenly it fits in your pocket and it has Wi-Fi access wherever you are, and the next generation of phone only a year or two later came along, and now you've got full-time internet data service. That's pretty decent. So this ability is really new, and the first generation of enterprise mobile apps is only 5 or 6 years old, because it took most companies a couple years to even decide that they wanted to get on that train. So now we're looking at a situation where the entire world expects your enterprise to be providing services and interaction with their customers through a mobile device. It's become, in a really dramatic short amount of time, the number one priority of a lot of companies and government agencies as well.
I mean, just as an aside, I mean, I remember when, you know, when web was a new thing and we were primarily doing the software for banking and other things like that at the time. It was a big thing when web as an interface to internet IT came along. Both these banks said, well, what will we put on a website for our bank? You know, our business hours and our phone number? You know, what's the big deal about this? And, you know, after, you know, 10 years, they barely have tellers anymore, and everyone does all their banking electronically, and the question seems, you know, unimaginable. Likewise, when mobile came along, you know, most of the companies did suck their toe in the water or did something fairly minimal, and, you know, and now this speed change is coming, and most of this is a primary interaction with all their customers. And, you know, that wave from, you know, first hint to, you know, complete transformation of business probably took half as much time as it did for the go-round with the web, which in turn, you know, sat on top of, you know, 50 years since the previous major way in which people did business transforms came around. I think, you know, it's pretty amazing to be a part of this, as well as, you know, thinking about, well, given those two ways in our fairly recent past, you know, hold on for the next one.
I was going to say, just elaborating on that, you know, some of the things that organizations are starting to look at are conceptual changes in the way they approach building a mobile app. It used to be that nobody had done it and nobody sort of knew what to expect. Well, now there are really interesting examples of mobile applications that have been designed and built pretty well, and they're, you know, they're easy to use. In a lot of cases, they're easier to use than interacting with a teller. You don't have to go to a bank. You don't have to deal with a person. The person doesn't have to write anything down on a ledger or type anything into an antiquated computer system that's slow and not very responsive. Like, the raw technology change has made, you know, the experience for the customer potentially a lot better. And yet, you still see quite a number of banks whose their web interface and their mobile interface is not up to the current standard. Like, you can look at the array of banking apps, and the really big banks kind of get this. And for the most part, their systems are pretty good. But the bank that I use, which is one of the top 20 banks, for the last couple years, up until maybe just a month or two ago, they seem to have updated it and this problem went away. It was a native app on the iPhone, and whenever I would go to use the keychain to fill in my password, the first time that I did that, the app would crash. And then the second time I did it, the app would take my username and password out of the keychain. Now, 2 years is a long time for a bug like that is the first thing you see when you use their app to survive. And this is a top 20 bank, and their app is pretty good in most other respects. So even the big organizations understand how important this is to their business. They still don't get it right all the time, and they still struggle with sort of how to maintain their software once they've written it. It's kind of a long-standing problem in the technology industry is that nobody invests in the ongoing maintenance of their system. They build it, and everybody likes building a new road. And so they create a project, they put a team together, and they build a new road, and then that team dissipates. The road is built, and most of that team goes on to do something else. But the road is being used, and every once in a while there's a pothole that needs to be fixed. And sometimes the cars get bigger and faster, and you have to straighten the curves out a little bit, or people are crashing and dying, which is not what's happening in banking software. But, there are sort of software equivalents of that, I suppose, in the healthcare industry. Which, by the way, is a funny thing, if you think about it, right? Like, we've become so dependent on these systems that this generational rethinking that is starting to take place now, second generation mobile apps and whatever, that is way more important than it sounds like when I just say that phrase. Because so much of our society now depends on this. And every day in the headlines, there are news about things being hacked and data being stolen and, voting machines being hacked. Well, it isn't just voting machines. It's everything. It's the systems that run the power grid, the systems that run the hospitals, the systems that run Social Security. Everything is always under attack.
So smart TV on your wall,
And soon it'll be your refrigerator and your watch.
It's sort of kind of an interesting thing. I'm old enough to remember the book Future Shock. There are several books that came after that postulated that you could get to a stage where new technology came along fast enough that people wouldn't be able to keep up with it anymore. And to a certain extent, I think that we always have a certain lag time. Stuff that you and I, Gary, know is actually going on today. I'd say 90% of people, if we pulled them off the street and asked them if they thought this was happening right now, would say no way. Whether it's in artificial intelligence or technology that's keeping track of what they're doing and trying to sell you stuff through internet ads or whatever else. Nonetheless, certain aspects of computing and certain problems that turn out to be solvable if you have enough computer power, are regularly being cracked today, and yet most people don't even realize that because it's just sounds too science fiction to them. But it would surprise most people, these capabilities that are going on today. And the question is, can we is there a point at which, everyone's cognition of what actually is going on with technology is disjointed from what's actually going on with technology? Or is it just going to be that, 90% of the people have no clue and there's, technology is, that remaining 10%, they're the ones who actually have some clue as to what's going on and why you can click on that on your phone or in your web browser, don't answer that phone call or whatever. Is it going to eventually take all of us, or is it just always going to be this divide?
That's a great question. That's a really great question because at present, the number of people who really get it, like you guys, is significantly below 10% even. So, yeah, is that gap always going to be there, or are the rest of us going to catch up a little bit as far as understanding of how these things are happening? And God willing, podcasts like this and getting to talk to you guys is a part of kind of breaking it down for people and helping them to understand it a little bit better. And as has been the case every time you've been on, Alex, I know that this has been the case. So I will start with you in bringing it around here full circle. Anything that we didn't cover yet that you would like to cover today?
I think one of the things that's always kind of an interesting prognostication is just, looking at where the market, we've been talking about various things and where the market is going. But, to a certain extent, Gary and I represent, two aspects of the market that are probably worth touching on. One, we generate stuff that we hope people will buy, and we're always looking at which software that should be, because you want to skip you know, feet to the right place where the puck is going to be in the near future, and also, you know, we're both involved in, you know, technology consulting, and, you know, that's a constantly shifting area in terms of, you know, what things, what kinds of things people come to consulting basis, you know, building technology, you know, prognosticating the future, and so on and so forth. So probably worth those two things bringing up, consulting and the engineering. Gary, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I don't want to leave your audience with the, on the doom and gloom note that I sounded a moment ago.
Sure.
There are things that we're doing with companies right now that are helping to address some of the issues I brought up. And, like, I'll give you an interesting example. You have a lot of IRS fans in your audience, I know, and it's one of the reasons why you want Alex on. If you look at what Apple has done, they have tried over the last several years, and I think done a better job than most platform providers of, you know, trying to stay a little ahead of the hackers. And one of the things that they've done in the last several years is poured an enormous amount of R&D into building a new compiler and programming language. The programming language is called Swift. The amount of money and brain power that went into that project is on par with what SpaceX invested in building a reusable rocket. It's really that big of a project. It might even be bigger. And that's something that there isn't a lot of appreciation for outside of the sort of, like, you know, hardcore geek community. That, you know, there are a lot of people in the geek world that kind of understand this. But one of the reasons why people are not really afraid to do banking on their mobile devices, even though lots of things are getting hacked, it's the back-end infrastructure and the bank's website that's getting hacked. Or in some cases, it's not even the bank. It's the people who are taking the credit card transactions, so the retail providers. They're in real trouble. Like, they're under assault all the time. They have mountains of credit card information, and it's valuable to the people who steal it. And they get hacked. You know, they're under continual assault. But Apple, when they built their new infrastructure, they did something really interesting, which is they said, okay, let's make a new programming language that makes it really hard to commit certain kinds of programming errors. Let's build into the language and into the compiler a way to build programs that does not allow the programmer to commit certain kinds of errors that are easily exploited. And then they open source this technology. So there are lots and lots of companies using the LLVM compiler for different languages, and there are a growing number of companies looking at Swift for different purposes. The language was originally intended and designed to be used for many different types of purposes. And this, I think, is a really positive thing. There are similar efforts going on elsewhere in the tech world. There's a language called Rust, which started from some similar design principles. They also set about building a language that made it hard to commit certain kinds of errors as a programmer. And these are really positive developments. The thing is, though, there is an enormous mountain of existing software written on other platforms and in other languages, and it will be a very long time before that stuff gets cleaned up and re-implemented in more modern environments, on more modern platforms, on Rust or on Swift. And some of that stuff will be with it probably for decades. Like, if you look at the software that's in the world today, some of the traces it leads back to the 60s,
right,
which is the birth of this stuff.
That's an excellent point. That really is, because, as was pointed out previously, we're just over a decade into the whole smartphone era. That's a wonderful point.
Yeah, and enterprises, the most forward-thinking enterprises are only 5 or 6 years into it. Almost no, I don't know, there were some experiments in the Fortune 500 before 5 years ago, but almost nobody really jumped wholeheartedly onto the mobile platform until Apple proved it. You know, Apple basically had to prove that it worked. They had to prove that there was a market for it, and that took a few years. You know, the first year only 4 million people bought an iPhone, and that's nothing if you're a top 20 bank. You know, you've got 100 million customers. And out of those 4 million, maybe only a half a million or a million of them are your customers. So it was really only 5 or 6 years ago that the first generation of mobile apps were built. And that's actually an interesting point, too, because what they're looking at now, you know, like one of the obvious questions that faces all these teams is, do we convert our application from Objective-C to Swift? And a lot of companies are reluctant to do that because it's an expensive undertaking. But it's really the right decision, and companies that decide to migrate to Swift are not going to regret it. And companies that stay on the older language, Objective-C, you know, it will be a while before they regret it, but eventually they're going to come to the point where they have to bite the bullet.
And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, whatever savings you might visualize that you could have from staying on your older technology, in any case, whatever values you might have done that are, you know, more than matched by the cost of moving to a new technology. So, you know, it really turns out to be a wash because net, the entire landscape, the computing environment where you're doing the work, the user interface metaphors, everything else like that, is moving so quickly that you really can't afford to conceptually write the software and let it sit there for a couple of years. You're constantly massaging this. We've just begun to start figuring out how to really communicate with people, computer to human, via phones and tablets and things like that. And, you know, and that, you know, that whole, you know, interaction level is still evolving really quickly. So you have to sit there and say, well, I'm going to rewrite this software over and over again anyway. I'm going to improve it anyway. You know, I should, wherever possible, take advantage of the latest, greatest tools and not be afraid to throw away what's come before, because, you know, this is not, you know, increasingly, you know, you used to be able to, you know, build a bank and then do banking in that bank for a long time before you had to rebuild your bank. Now, with, you know, mobile technology, this stuff is, you know, is in constant state of flux, and you have to plan for being in a dynamic situation as opposed to a static situation.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of interesting paradigm opportunities that come along with that, too. Like enterprises that are rebuilding their mobile app right now, they get to take advantage of ideas that emerge from the social media world. You know, Facebook and Twitter and a bunch of other platforms have put a ton of energy into figuring out how do you engage with a big audience and how do you get them to be interested in your products. Some of those techniques maybe don't carry over to a banking application, but some of them might. And if you have any other kind of good or service that you're providing over the internet, the chances for borrowing techniques from the social media world or from the things that we've learned building games, this is actually an area called gamification. You can solve problems by enticing people to come to your platform and play a game. Famously, Google has done some experiments along these lines when they were trying to figure out how to build artificial intelligence that would look at an image and identify as just, you know, are there dogs in this image? Are there frisbees in this image? Are there cars? Are there people? Are there men or women, boys or girls? One of the things that they did was they built games that they would put up on the web, and they would let a bunch of people play it, and they would see, okay, how do people identify these things, and how accurate are all people that identify? Sometimes people get it wrong and miscount the number of dogs. That type of technology, you know, it's an enormous mountain, again, of experience in the field that you can borrow into your app sometimes. And looking for those opportunities is really important and difficult. It's, you know, it's certainly not easy to take a sort of boring business app and figure out, okay, how do you make the customers like it better? The first thing you do is you make a quality experience where it's easy for people to do what they want to do in your app. But the second thing you do is you try to make it fun. If you can make the software fun for the audience, if they don't hate your software, they're not going to hate your company. And this is a funny thing. It's like, you know, Rick, I'd like to ask you.
Yes.
Almost everybody has an experience that they can think of, usually within the last few days. Was there a time when you were using software that made you frustrated or upset?
Yes, it happens all the time, and you know, I think it probably always will be the case. And even as everything gets exponentially better and more advanced over a period of time, that does unfortunately seem to be the one constant.
and I think that's really common. I'm a little more optimistic. I think it has gotten better, and I think it will continue to get better. But again, turning over the whole infrastructure, it's kind of like we know how to build a green office building now, but our office buildings that we built over the last 100 years still have a 50 years or 75 years or 25 years of life expectancy in them, and it's going to take us 100 years to turn the inventory over and turn the stock over so that we have a bunch of green buildings.
That's true.
The software is the same way.
That's true, yes. And in terms of the evolution of it, it is very fascinating tracking it with gentlemen such as you two who can really speak to this so eloquently. So, Gary, your first time being on with us, I certainly hope it won't be the last time, CEO of Illuminex. Thank you very much for being on, Gary, for your part in this great discussion.
It's been really enjoyable for me, Rick. I appreciate you having us on.
I truly appreciate having you, and Alex Cohn, wonderful as always to have you on, as was the previous occasions. Thank you so much for your perspectives. Look forward to having you back on as well, sir.
Always a pleasure. I like to put your advocating wherever I can.
Really appreciate having you guys on. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you everybody for tuning in to FDH Lounge Mini Episode number 1052.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classics, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.